Good evening, one and all. Yes, it's a Wednesday. It's February. Yes, already. I know. And here it is with me, Barry Eva, with another book and a chat. Well, it's getting to, I think we've got a cold blast coming here in Connecticut, where I am, and where my guest is as well. We were just sort of talking about how the weather seems to have shifted this last decade or so to the sort of February time, and we are expecting a cold blast towards the end of the week, but we can't complain. We've had good stuff so far. Anyway, one of the things, as I've mentioned before, I like doing is looking at the reaction videos on YouTube, where people react, to a piece of music or a bit of film or anything like that. And one of the things that surprises me is that you get these sort of 20, 30-year-olds looking at, say, Abbott and Costello, who's on first for the first time. I mean, it ages really well, but I can Abbott and Costello are more, lot more than that, because I can remember, well, before Scooby-Doo, they were the ones that met the monsters. I can remember seeing like Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein and stuff like that. Saturday morning pictures when I was young. And of course, we had pictures a lot in the old those days. Every Sunday afternoon, we had a classic, all the road films and everything like that used to be on BBC and everything. Well, my guest today, he can tell us all about that, because when it comes to old films and things like old comedians and that, I love the music hall and late Rod Hull and Roy Hudd, Rod Hull, Rod Hull, he was one of the Roy Hudd, and all the musical stuff and everything like that. But he knows all that and the things like that. So I better introduce him, because we've got a lot to talk about. Because on the show today, I have the one and only Lou Sabini. Hi, Lou, how you doing?
Hi, Barry. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. But as I said, I mean, you've just got a few. I mean, you're. When it comes to old films and old comedians and stuff like that, you are the man. I mean, how many titles, say 16mm? I know you've got a whole collection of them. How many have you got of those?
I have over 1,000.
Oh my goodness.
Mainly features and shorts, but I have quite a few, and most of them, a lot of them are from the pre-code era
Right.
of Hollywood.
Yeah, well, that's something we get to admit, but it's like I said, because same age as me, sort of thing, brought up at the same time. Somebody said to me, there was a quiz thing I had to do on Facebook the other day. Somebody, first film you ever saw, and I know exactly what it is. I got taken to the cinema. First time I got taken to the cinema, and it was Westward Ho! The Wagons, and it was a double Disney bill, and it was on with a film called Piri about a red squirrel. And it's amazing how this stuff sticks in your mind, let alone all the say the Saturday morning and the serials, see next week and everything like that. And then, as I said, Sunday afternoon, we used to have a Sunday film matinee on BBC. We all used to sit down as a family after Sunday lunch and watch all that sort of stuff. But it's not just that, is it? It's the comedians and everything that were around in those days.
Oh, yes. I mean, the first film I ever saw in the movie theater was at the Old Rialto here in Stamford, Connecticut. And the movie was Abbott and Costello's last movie, Dance with Me Henry. And that
Ah!
was in 1956, the same year as Westward Ho! The Wagon.
Right. It just shows you. I mean, it's about that. Yeah, I remember. I must have been about five, definitely. I remember. But my eldest sister was born. I remember her going there. She must have been two, three, something like that. But yeah, but. Yeah, like as I said, the Saturday morning, we always used to have Abbott and Costello when they had all the monster things, and people sort of watch Scooby-Doo and think, well, this is, like a comedy thing with these people. But no, Abbott and Costello did that decades and decades before that.
Oh yeah, no, they were wonderful. They were probably my first. They were my first introduction to motion pictures. It was probably like a year later when I really got the Laurel and Hardy bug, because they turned into my absolute favorites. And as a matter of fact, years later, I started corresponding with Stan Laurel.
Really?
And I got
Oh.
to speak with him on the telephone back in 1964, just like 2 or 3 months before he passed away. And years later, my wife and I were at Hal Roach's house, who produced all those great Laurel and Hardy comedies of the 30s, 20s and 30s, rather.
Do you know they actually had a number one hit in the charts in England?
Laurel and Hardy did.
They
Yes.
did, yes.
That was in 1975. It was The Trail of the Lonesome
Lonesome
Pine.
Pine, yep.
they sang in their movie Way Out West.
Way Out West, yes. I knew you knew that. I said, I bet I'm not going to fool him with that. Bring it out to him. But I mean, the 50s and that was sort of the censorship has started. But what about before censorship? What about the pre-code years, sort of like late 20s, early 30s, and stuff like that?
Yes.
A lot of stuff used to be got away with in that time, didn't it?
Well, in what was going on was in the silent era, films were getting very risque. There was a lot of violence in them and a lot of sordidness and an emphasis on sex. And so people, a lot of civic groups like the Catholic Church and women's groups were, there was this outcry to clean up the motion picture industry. And they wanted to get the government involved, and Hollywood, rather than getting the government, they set up their own set of rules, and they hired their own censorship czar named Will Hayes.
Okay.
He was an ex-postmaster general during the Harding administration, and this guy was making $1.7 million. $1.7 million
in
a year.
In the 20s? 30s?
Yeah, in 1922. Yeah, I mean,
goodness,
he was making
me
loads of money.
Okay.
But the thing was that Hollywood really wasn't standing by his rules. I mean, they kind of thought it was a joke. And movies just kept getting, rougher and rougher. And finally, between 1929 and 1934, that was the true pre-code era, because
right.
Talkies pretty much came in. They were very popular in 1929, and then the code came in July of 1934. So movies now, there were these great gangster films like Little Caesar with Eddie Robinson, The Public Enemy with James Cagney, and Scarface with Paul Muni. But the Catholic Church and also our government officials were saying that they were glorifying the American hoodlum.
Right.
And they didn't want that done anymore. So after that, the censorships came in 1934. I mean, there were movies, sex dramas like Babyface from 1933 with Barbara Stanwyck.
Yes.
And the story of Temple Drake from 1933, Three on a Match. I mean, those are probably the best pre-code films to check out.
Now, you share this in your books, Sex in the Cinema, Pre-Code Years, 1929 to 1934. I mean,
yes.
Obviously, a lot of sort of round about that time, just after, there was that whole business, wasn't there, with the rape trials of Fatty Arbuckle?
Well, that came before. That was actually in the early 20s, and that's why Will Hayes came in. But in 1934, Hayes hired somebody named Joseph H. Breen to head the code, and he was very strict and very difficult to work with. So movies just changed drastically after 1934. I mean, they were family-oriented, definitely.
See, it's funny, you say Will Hayes. I keep thinking of, is it Will Hay? The person
Will Hayes, a comedian.
Yeah.
He's marvelous.
Oh, Mr. Porter, wasn't it? Was
exactly.
The train station.
I have that.
Oh, classic. Yeah. The other thing is, I seem to remember something about a silent movie being so shocking that even now people are reluctant to watch it. I can't think what it was, but I read somewhere recently about that even today this silent movie is meant to be, still hard to watch sort of thing. I can't think what it was, but
I mean, I don't know whether you're talking about the 1933 Czechoslovakian film Ecstasy with Hedy Lamarr, which is essentially a silent movie. But I don't think so. I think you're probably talking about something else.
Yeah, something else.
I would love to know what movie it is.
I know. I'd have to check up on that, but I will do. I will do. I'll try and check up.
Yes,
and if I do find it, I'll let you know. But it's something it might have been somebody else had written a book with similar sort of things, on a similar theme that I'd had on the show, and it might have just been something I found there. Anyway, but the whole business, I mean, when did I guess it was a lot after that the whole communist witch hunts and everything started. Was that 40s?
Well, I mean, there was one in the 30s, and then there was another one, obviously, in the late 40s. You know, the House of Un-American
yeah.
Activities Committee that came much later. Yeah, I mean, that really had nothing to do with the pre-code era.
No, but the films, I mean, you think of the films in those days. I mean, the old adage about, you know, the couch and everything like that. I mean, things were going on that people didn't realise. And it was just accepted in that sort of industry, wasn't it, in the sort of 20s, 30s?
Well, you mean the casting couch?
Casting couch. I couldn't think of the casting word. Yeah, brain's going.
Yeah, in some cases, yes. I mean, you know, I mean, women had to be really tough. I mean, like Betty Davis, for instance, when she came to Warner Brothers, she was put in a lot of terrible, terrible parts, you know, films beneath her dignity. And she was loaned out to RKO for a movie called Of Human Bondage, which she really wanted to do. And she got these rave reviews, and she came back to Warner Brothers, and she said to Jack Warner, please, you know, give me something good. And they put her in a James Cagney film where she just played an ingenue called Jimmy the Gent. And she became friends with Cagney, and she asked him, well, geez, Jim, what do I do? You know, how can I get better roles? And he said, demand them and hold out, and they will see to it that you get better roles. And she did. She got a movie in 1935 called Dangerous, and she won her first Academy Award for that.
Right.
So, Ginger Rogers was another case.
Right.
I mean, her mother was her agent, and Lila Rogers, and she made sure her daughter was treated with respect, and you know, she was
pretty tough, wasn't she, if I remember reading right?
Lila Rogers was, yes, yeah, she definitely was. But you know, who used to live in Connecticut, and I interviewed her years ago, and she worked in a lot of pre-code films with Sylvia Sidney.
Mm-hmm.
And she lived in Danbury, Connecticut. She was I interviewed her. She was in movies like Dead End, directed by William Wyler. She was in Trail of the Lonesome Pine with Henry Fonda and Fred McMurray. And some of her pre-code films were The Miracle Man from 1932, An American Tragedy, Confessions of a Coed, which is kind of a wild film. But, Connecticut, believe it or not, there were a lot of people from old Hollywood who lived here in Connecticut, especially in Westport.
I think I might have been talking about The Unknown, the film, 27.
Oh, The Unknown. Yeah, The Unknown. I have that. That's with John Crawford. Lon Chaney and John Crawford. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a very strange film. I mean, but most of Chaney's films have the same theme of unrequited love.
Yeah, it's sort of like Phantom of the Opera before Phantom of the Opera. Sort of thing.
Well, actually, it came 2 years after Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, did it? Because that was 27, or 25, was it? Yeah.
Phantom of the Opera was 25, and The Unknown was 27.
Okay. I said, you know, about your knowledge of films and stuff like that, but you are an expert when it comes down to one film in particular, behind the scenes of They Were Expendable, which is a U.S. Navy film, isn't it? Something like that?
Yes. What happened with that, and it's very interesting how I got to write that book. The book pretty much chronicles the filming of the movie, the 1945 MGM classic war picture, They Were Expendable, which was directed by John Ford, and it starred Robert Montgomery, John Wayne, and Donna Reed. And it's just a wonderful film. The way I got to write that, I mean, what got me to write that film, I have a friend who works at the Stanford Historical Society, and he sent me an email, and there were two pictures. And he asked me, Lou, could you identify these photographs? And I said, well, yes, they look like candid shots. One picture was director John Ford lying on the ground talking to John Wayne, Robert Montgomery, and Jack Holt, who also appeared in the picture. And another picture was of a man sitting on a Jeep with Robert Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, these are obviously taken during the making of They Were Expendable. I said, however, I don't know who the young man is sitting next to Robert Montgomery. And he said, well, Lou, that's the fellow who took the first picture, the first picture I sent you. His name is Nick Scutti. Now, Nick Scutti, as you probably know, Nick Scutti co-authored behind the scenes of They Were Expendable with me.
Mm-hmm.
He was there in Miami when they were shooting the location scenes. It was a 30-day shoot of They Were Expendable down in Miami Beach. And he was there, and he took a few pictures. And I had asked my friend Dan, I said, gee, could you get me in touch with Nick? Because I'd like to perhaps interview him and maybe write an article about his day on the set of They Were Expendable. Because I'm a big John Wayne mm-hmm. and John Ford fan, not to mention Robert Montgomery and Donna Reed. And he said, sure. So I talked to, I went to Nick's house, and lo and behold, I found out that Nick was a very good friend of my mother's and my uncle. He was best friends with my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, I said, so Nick, were you there for a day? And he said, no, Lou, I was there for the whole 30-day shoot.
Wow.
I said, oh, and you only took two pictures? So he said, excuse me. And he left the room, and he came back in, and he had a shoebox with 153 photographs. And I said, Nick, we have a book here chronicling the whole shoot of They Were Expendable. And, you know, the book was, the movie was based on a book, They Were Expendable, by William White. And it's an excellent book. And the movie is fictitious, but there are some scenes in it that are based on what really happened during World War II. It's a very bittersweet, sad movie for World War II, but
mm-hmm.
it is excellent. It's one of the best films made during the war. Sadly, it was released after the war ended. It was released in December of 1945, and the war had ended months before. But it still made a lot of money for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. But the book did very well for me critically. Leonard Maltin, who is a noted film historian and critic, he used to be on Entertainment Tonight. He gave my book a great review, and so did Robert Osborne, of all people, who was on Turner Classic Movies for many, many years. Also, I wanted to mention to you, when I went to write this book,
mm-hmm.
I had to get clearance from John Ford's grandson, Dan Ford.
Really?
To use photographs of his grandfather because he owned the rights to his grandfather's image. And then somebody else contacted me, this other author named Bill Levy, who's a very good friend of mine. And Bill said, you know, Lou, you have to contact Ethan Wayne, John Wayne's son.
Right.
Because he owns the rights to his father's image. So I had to contact Ethan Wayne. And, I mean, all of them were very, very nice to me, and they helped me out considerably. I had a lot of help on the book, and it was just great. One of the highlights of the book is a wonderful interview with Nick Scutti, who was there every day. And he did get to mingle with actors Robert Montgomery, John Wayne. He even got to talk to John Ford, the studio still photographer for MGM. I mean, it was just a wonderful experience working with Nick Scutti.
So obviously, you know, you got the permission and you contacted these people. And were you surprised how much you found out about, you know, what was going on behind the scenes with this film?
Yes, yeah, and it's all there in the book. I mean, you know, John Wayne, according to Nick Scutti, was one of the nicest guys. He said the first day of the shoot, they would go on these PT boats out
mm-hmm.
to this
yep.
little remote island and shoot some scenes. And he said they were getting onto the PT boat, and John Wayne didn't have a shirt on. And he turned to Nick and he said, hey, can you give me a cigarette?
Yeah.
And later that day, it was lunch, and John Wayne was sitting under a tent with Ward Bond. And Ward Bond was kind of cantankerous. He had broken his foot prior to the shoot.
Whoops.
And they had to play his injury into the picture in the movie. He gets
Is he in a jeep and he can't or something to do with a jeep? He comes out limping or something like that. Was that it?
Actually, he gets shot in the foot
in the
movie.
Yeah,
but he was in a car accident, and he actually was in a car accident.
Right.
So he was in a cantankerous mood, and they were sitting there John Wayne and Ward Bond having lunch, and Nick was walking with a buddy of his, and Nick was a photographer. And Nick asked, he said, Mr. Bond, could I take your picture? And Ward Bond said, nah, get out of here. And John Wayne stopped and says, whoa, Ward, come on, let him take a picture. So Nick took the picture, but Ward Bond put his arm up, and he wouldn't let him see his face.
Oh.
So the next day, Nick was walking with his buddy again, and Ward Bond is calling Nick to come over. And Nick says, oh, geez, what does this guy want? And he walks over, and Ward Bond said, you could take my picture now if you want to. and he took Ward Bond's picture, and it's in the book. I mean, there's just so many fascinating stories about the making of it. And another thing that I want to tell you about the book, it brought me a lot of, I guess you could say, a lot of acclaim, because I was invited to a screening at Grauman's Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. For its 70th anniversary, and I introduced the movie to and you know, it was a packed house. It was at Cinecon in 2015, and what happened was they invited John Wayne's kids and Dan Ford, and John Wayne's kids couldn't make it. Ethan got in touch with me. He said, "Look, Lou, I'm not going to be driving on Labor Day weekend to Hollywood."
Yeah.
He said it'll take the hours to get there.
So
anyhow, Dan Ford did show up, and Dan used to be on the Tonight Show. He used to be with the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the writers for the show, and we were sitting outside. I was signing books, you know, and people were buying my books out in the lobby. And these two young men came up to, not young men, I shouldn't say young, they're my age. I still think of myself as being young.
Yeah, I know the
I'm young at heart, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyhow, they came up to me and they said, Mr. Sabini, can you autograph our book? I said, yes. I said, what are your names? He said, well, my name is Tim Owen, and this is my brother Tony. I said, okay, so I autographed it, and they said, now we can go see our mother on the screen. I said, wait a minute. Are you Donna Reed's sons? And he said, yes,
we right.
are. So it was Donna Reed's sons.
Yeah.
And then a few months later, I was invited to the Lambs Club in Manhattan.
Right.
And Nick and I were there, and we did a little presentation, a slideshow presentation of the book. And a woman came up to me, and she said, you know, Mr. Sabini, I had a choice. It was either to go see Buster Keaton tonight in The General in Greenwich, Connecticut, with live musical accompaniment, or to watch you. And I said, I would have taken Keaton. and she said to me, well, you met my two brothers in California. I said, are you Donna Reed's daughter, Mary Owen? And she's a doll. She's been to our house.
Oh, nice.
But the biggest thrill was I was invited by the Library of Congress for the 70th anniversary of They Were Expendable, and I got to introduce the movie at the Library of Congress.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
By the way, you've given me, when you said about the launch sort of thing, I suddenly thought this was, and I found that other film. I don't think it's quite what I thought it was, but it was because of the, it was released nationwide in Masters of Cinema Restoration, and it was F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu.
Yeah, Nosferatu. Yeah,
yeah.
That's Dracula.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the silent version.
Yeah,
of Dracula.
That's Dracula. The one they were on about. So yeah. Nosferatu.
Yeah. Bernal is terrific. I mean, his masterpiece was a 1927 silent film called Sunrise, which is just one of the best films ever made.
Oh, there used to be a program on, it wasn't on BBC, it must have been ITV, and I want to say that Frank, I can't think of his name, I can picture the boat, used to do this silent movie, and he went back through a lot of the old silent movies and had clips on the silent movies. This must have been in the 60s, I think. But and so, you know, I saw a lot of these, not just at the cinema, but on the television. We used to have them. We used to watch. I never forget, is it the Buster Keaton one? Is that the one where he's standing in front of the house and the whole front of the house falls down around him and he's just standing there where the top window was? Just a one-off snap.
That's Steamboat Bill Jr. from 1928.
Yeah.
That
was just an amazing bit of photography. No tricks, anything, you know. He just stood there.
He could have been killed.
Of course, he just stood there where the house fell the whole frontage of the house came down, and he happened to be standing where the sort of entrance to the loft bit was, wasn't it? I mean, it's you look back on them, and you think, oh my goodness, how did they do that?
it's just amazing. And you know, I mean, he had to calculate that mathematically. Otherwise, he would have been killed.
Yeah.
That facade was a few tons. You know, it was very heavy.
Of course
it would have killed him.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
Anyway, it has been. I'm just. The clock's disappeared. I don't know where time's gone. It's whizzed past. It's been great. And it's obviously because we've been having such a great chat and a great show. But what I'm going to do now, Lou, is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find more about you and, of course, about your books.
Okay. Well, my books are available, obviously, through Amazon. The one is called Sex in the Cinema, the pre-code years, 1929 to 1934. Bear Manor is a publisher, and you could get it through Bear Manor's website, or you could buy it right on Amazon. It's still in print. And the other book is by McFarland, and it's called Behind the Scenes of They Were Expendable, A Pictorial History, by myself, and the photographs are by Nicholas Scuddy, who I will say is... He just turned 97 years old.
Wow.
Great health. And God bless him. He's a wonderful guy.
It's terrific. Well, it's been really great chatting to you. I'm glad we managed to get together on this with help from friends. And
Gary, this was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
It's been a real pleasure. Good luck with the books and everything like that. And perhaps if something else comes out, or else you can just come back and we'll have another chat. So thank you so much for being a guest on the show. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, there you go. How about that? Really interesting. I love it when we talk about stuff like that. And I mean, we could have gone on chatting for hours, if you might have guessed from the way it was going. But that was my guest today. Yes, Lou Sabini, S-A-B-I-N-I. And you can just look like I did, look up on Amazon for him or you know, or Barnes & Noble and stuff like that. Easy enough to find. And you find about his books, about him and everything like that. Just on the Amazon page, it's got great stuff like that. Well, that's it. Now, I'll be back next week. But, of course, before then, on Sunday, we have from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, we have Those Were the Days, music from the 20th century. And February is my birthday month. So what I do during my birthday month in February is to have Barry's Picks. So no theme or anything like that, except theme of stuff that I like. So we've got 4 weeks of that. So listen out for that. Some of my stuff, and I'm sure a lot of other people out there will like it. And then, of course, after that, from 6 to 7 p.m. here on New Visions Radio, it is the Swinging 60s. Music from the 60s, not just the British Invasion, but from around the world. And then, of course, next Tuesday, I'll be back with a fresh guest. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...